Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Humans have kept cats around for thousands of years, valued for their ability to keep rodents out of our food. But up until the last couple hundred years, these adept hunters were more a presence in our lives than pets. That, however, began to change in the Victorian era. Breeding became popular, and felines became objects to be admired and loved. But in recent years, some breeders have been returning to the wild side with exotic hybrid cats, part domestic, part wild, with results that have raised ethical questions about what responsible cat ownership really means. And these are the themes explored in a forthcoming episode of NHPR's Outside In. The producer of that episode will join us, Justine Paradise. Later, we'll bring in author David Grimm, who's written a lot about our relationship with cats and dogs. And of course, as always, let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And producer Justine Paradise is with me in studio. And Justine, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also, listeners, hey, if you're thinking, I'm not a cat person, this doesn't interest me, stick around, because this episode really does raise larger questions about what we want from our animals, both domestic and wild, and how we act on those desires. So, Justine, let's start there. You got into this topic by looking at one particular breed of cat, the Bengal tiger. We're going to talk about that for sure. But beyond the particulars of this cat, what are the themes that drew you into this that made you think, oh, this is a bigger story than this really beautiful cat?
Sure. Well, this actually first interested me many years ago when I was studying ecology at school. And I was sort of looking hard at, you know, this sort of global sense of loss that we're having as it's a big extinction of a lot of different species. We're seeing climate change. We're seeing a lot of changes in our environment. And a friend of mine was studying bobcats, actually. He was studying coyotes on a nearby preserve. And his trail cam captured a photo of a bobcat. And I found myself so enthralled by this sight of a wildcat living so near to us. And at the same time, the New Yorker magazine came out with an article, Aria Levy, she came out with an article called Feline Dreams, which was about the Bengal cats. And I know I compared my interest in this wildcat and my complete, I was completely overcome. I was so amazed that there was this bobcat living so near us. And there was this trend in breeding wildcat hybrids. And I started to think about, what is this, you know, we're both interested, both me and these breeders, in this quality of wildness, or drawn to the look of a wildcat. And what does that mean, that in our society we're interested in that quality? And that's something that goes back for hundreds and thousands of years, people interested in wildcats.
So it's about a lot more than, you know, breeders doing interesting and sometimes difficult things with these cats. Some of them are a little too wild. We'll talk about that. It's about this connection that we have with wildness and how cats in particular represent that.
Right. And also, we're seeing sort of the global decline of a lot of the big wild cats. And at the same time, we love their images in cartoons. We love using leopard print on our clothing. I noticed that, and also naming our sports teams, you know, we see their names and their image everywhere. And I started to be interested in this idea that as things begin to vanish, they become more and more visible in a way. We start to be more and more interested in having their image around. And I'm interested in different ways that we can commodify ideas. So commodifying the idea of wildness, like if I wear this leopard print or if I drive this car that has this name, it says something about me, or it connects me to this thing and makes me feel like I'm living a little bit more on the edge or something.
That's really interesting. And you interviewed a lot of people for this forthcoming episode, but I want to play a little clip, Justine, from a Bengal cat breeder, Denise Eckert. She talks in this clip we're going to hear about this connection, this fascination, this draw to something wild. You asked her, would you consider breeding any other type of cat? And she says, I will only breed these Bengal cats. Let's hear from Denise Eckert.
And there's so many things that I see in them that are more wild than your average domestic. It's so interesting that, like, body language and the energy that is put into everything that they do, and that sort of the crouching walking is more than your average. It's just more.
Yeah, and you hear that from her and a couple of the people in the piece. These animals that are part wild, part domestic, just seem to have more.
You know, she really hit the nail on the head, and I think that that's why people are drawn to them. And I, you know, when me and producer Hannah McCarthy and I both went to this to her cattery, as it's called, and you know, neither of us really went in kind of expecting to be overcome by it, but you know, we left and we said, you know, she's right, that there is kind of an energy to them. So Bengal cats are a wildcat hybrid. They're a cross between, they're descendants of a cross between the Asian leopard cat, which is a very small, solitary wildcat native to Southeast Asia and some of those islands, and the domestic short hair, just a regular cat.
Well, so it really is a crossbreed.
Yes, yeah. So it's, I mean, it's descended, so there, it's a lot of them are many generations away at this point, although there are some still being introduced that are new crosses of the Asian leopard cat and the domestic short hair. But they have these genes in them that are from, that are much closer to their wild ancestor than some of our cats, other domestic cats that we have around us.
So you wrote in this story, and I thought it was so well said, Justine. You said people want cats that look wild on the outside but are domestic on the inside. But, you know, nature has her own ways of working things out. I mean, have these Bengal cats been a little too wild?
Well, that, I think, really depends on the breeder. You know, and I didn't even write that. That's the goal of the Bengal breeding program, is explicitly, quote, to create a domestic cat which has physical features distinctive to the small forest-dwelling wildcats and with the loving, dependable temperament of the domestic cat. That is the explicit goal of the Bengal breeding program. They also call them lap leopards sometimes.
Lap leopards.
Yes. And, you know, I think I want to be come right out and say, like, not all breeding programs are the same. So there are some that are more careful about pedigrees and about with the motivation to create a really domestic temperament. And then there are some that are, I would guess, are interested in the high price tags of these cats. So I did talk to a wildcat sanctuary out in Minnesota, and about 25% of their population is consistently wildcat hybrids that have been given up, not just Bengals, but also Savannahs, which are crosses between an African serval and a domestic cat. And she says that, you know, it's similar to a lot of, you know, people say this about something like a Siberian Husky a lot. They love the look of the Siberian Husky, but the behavior of the Siberian Husky, they have a lot of energy, they love digging, they're an intense dog to have sometimes, and if you're not prepared for that, you might not enjoy having that dog in your house. And the same is true of a Bengal. They're very vocal, they love water, so by very vocal, they meow a lot. They're kind of a communicator. I hear reports that they can be aggressive. I think, again, it depends on the cat. And then I've also heard that they spray rather a lot. That's something that the Wildcat Sanctuary told me, which means, you know, mark their territory with their scent. That's also something that domestic cats do. I think that sometimes it might be more pronounced in Bengal cats, although that seems to be in dispute. Some breeders say to me, no, all cats do that. And others say, no, it's more pronounced.
So in a way, Justine, it seems like, you know, don't blame anybody, especially not the animal, but recognize what you're getting into with some of these hybrids. They're demanding animals to have around.
Right. The Wildcat Sanctuary basically told me the biggest thing that they hear is that the breeder never told me that. And what's interesting is it's wanting things both ways. This fundamental conflict with, can you have wildness and have the personality of a domestic cat? And that gets down to the genetic level. Where is wildness? Where is tameness in the genetic code? And there's, I talked to a geneticist, Leslie Lyons, about this, and she said, you know, we still don't really know. There have been some really long-running experiments. The Siberian fox fur farm experiment is very famous in the mid-century, where there was a fox fur farm where they basically wanted foxes to be easier to handle. And this geneticist, Dmitry Belayev, he basically stuck a stick in the stage and watched the fox's reaction, and if they bit it or cowered or looked at it curiously, he would breed the ones that were more curious or a little more afraid together. And over a very short period of time, he saw a complete transformation of not only the fox's appearance, or not only the fox's personality, but also their appearance. They very quickly turned into very dog-like, with a curly tail and floppy ears and spotted fur.
So you can breed domestic qualities.
What it suggests is that the appearance and the personality are close together genetically, that they're bundled in some way, or maybe not bundled, but close on the genetic code. And so how do you separate that out? Is it possible? And that's also something that Charles Darwin, noticed as well. He identified what's called the domestication syndrome, which is essentially what I just described: floppy ears, curly tail, spotted fur. And cats don't have a lot of those qualities. They have the spotted fur, but they have, you know, sharp pointy ears, long tail. They don't exhibit a lot of the qualities of a regular domesticated animal. So there's another question of, are cats domesticated animals?
Wow. Okay, so a lot more to it than just these pretty cats that are kind of expensive and that some people want. And I want to invite our listeners again to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the ethics of cat ownership and questions that some new breeds are raising about what domestication really means. These are some of the themes raised in a forthcoming episode from NHPR's Outside In team. What's wild? What's domestic? Why the lines can sometimes be fuzzy? And as we're hearing from Justine Paradise, there's a lot of science in here as well. The number again for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Again, you can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Justine, somebody else who plays a role in your episode is Abigail Tucker, author of the pretty famous book, The Lion in the Living Room. She feels uneasy about some of these wild / domestic hybrid cat breeds. Let's hear a little from Abigail Tucker.
They're sort of commodifying something that is like the wildest thing that we have left on the earth. And I think that, you know, if the sometimes these hybrid cat breeders will argue, well, but these cats are ambassadors for animals like lions and tigers. But I'm not sure that that's always true. I mean, lions and tigers and stuff like that, they're a pain to keep alive, and it's expensive to preserve them. And none of us get any like personal pleasure out of petting them. It's just something that we need to do because it's the right thing to do. Whereas like having a cat of any kind is at heart a selfish act. We have cats because we like cats.
Abigail Tucker, author of The Lion in the Living Room, in a forthcoming episode by NHPR's Justine Paradise, looking at domestication of cats and more about the science and ethics of cat ownership. And Justine, I was kind of struck by that. Like, what is she saying there? It's a selfish act to own a cat?
She is saying that domestic cats would be fine without us. They would be fine not living in our house. They have been with us for about 12,000 years, mostly living at the edges of our environments, living in alleys, catching rodents in grain storage houses. It is really just the last 50 years or so since the invention of kitty litter and since the invention of pet food that they've been welcomed into our houses and welcomed into our living rooms and onto our couches, which that was Abigail Tucker's motivation for writing the book. Was she looked at her cat on her couch and wondered how it got there. And when we talk about Bengals and cat breeding, you know, when Abigail said, people say that the motivation is to be ambassadors for tigers and leopards and wildcats, I think that a lot of the breeders genuinely do love these wildcats, and I'm not trying to dismiss that. And that's Jean Mills, who created the Bengal breed, said that that was her motivation when she originally tried to create the Bengal breed, was that she had seen people wearing fur, and she thought, you know, if we had this object in your house, you wouldn't need to buy fur. You would already have it in a living creature. But for me, that kind of points to this other idea, which is that the cat becomes almost an aesthetic object as well, where like a piece of art almost. And, you know, people have said that I'm an artist. I'm painting with jeans.
Really? Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. And so to me, that makes me a little uneasy. It speaks to that what I mentioned before about commodifying different qualities aesthetically in a living creature. So, but as far as the, it's been interesting to think about how do we think about pets as part of American life? And the fact that this is only about 50 years old, you know, makes, as far as cats go, living inside our houses and our living rooms, you know, there are exceptions. But, you know, we mentioned the Victorian age at the beginning. The cat breed before that was something that was not really considered. There were maybe 16 cat breeds. And since then, 1871 at the Crystal Palace, when we had our first cat show, you know, we had dog shows, we had guinea pig shows, we had fancy rat shows. Fancy mice, which are the beautiful little white mice that you see. You know, this is the examples of the fancy, which is a hobby, essentially. It's there are all different kinds of pedigreed animal fancies. The Westminster Dog Show would be the pinnacle of the dog fancy. But the Victorian age was all about classifying nature. It was about classifying humans as to what was better or worse. And that's when Darwin was coming out with his theories. There was a big moment of thinking about the world around us in the Victorian age, and cats were no exception to that.
Well, in a minute, Justine, I'll ask you about what the difference between a breed and a species is, because I know that's an issue. Yeah, exactly. But let's go to our listeners. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. You can always send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Lydia's calling in from Goshen. Hi, Lydia. Thanks for being with us. Go ahead. You're in the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a Bengal. I've had since he was 6 weeks old. He's 16 now. It's the second cat I've ever had. And he's been a wonderful companion. However, when he was young, he was aggressive. And he was aggressive toward me. And he was difficult to train, although I did stick with it. It took a long time. By difficult, I mean that I had him too close to my mouth as a kitten, and he bit my lip.
Yeah, ouch.
That lip. He also, he had a mind of his own, and he would take off. I didn't want him to be outside. I'd take him out on a leash, but sometimes he would escape, and he would terrorize the other cats in the neighborhood.
So Lydia is basically saying kind of what you said earlier, Justine, that, you know, it's not a knock against these cats or the people who breed them, but as Lydia's pointing out, you kind of need to know what you're getting into. Thank you, Lydia, so much for sharing your story.
Thank you, Lydia. I think again, it depends on the cat and on the individual, but good for Lydia for sticking with it, because one of the things that the Wildcat Sanctuary sort of said is, you know, when you're getting into this, know what you're getting into, and be committed to the animal for life, because we have this whole other side of this, which is there are so many animals in shelters who are unwanted. That's a big criticism of cat breeding in general, not just of Bengal breeding. And then cat breeders sort of respond to that with saying, you know, I have the right to choose what I want. If I am a responsible breeder and I find homes for my cats and my kittens that I breed, then it's not a problem. Others sort of say, you know, there is no responsible cat breeding.
Well, Lydia, thank you for the call. Yeah, you mentioned in your episode, Justine, that talking about cat breeding and the science and the ethics and so forth that you dig into does often raise this bigger debate for people, adopt, don't shop.
Exactly.
So that's what you're talking about there.
Exactly, the adopt, don't shop idea.
Okay. We will talk a lot more after a short break, and keep taking your calls at 1-800-892-6477. We're also going to bring in David Grimm, a journalist who's written extensively about societal views and knowledge about pets. He's the author of the book Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. And he's got a lot of history about how cats came to be domesticated. So we'll talk about that coming up. Also, keep taking your questions. You can call, like Lydia did, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org.
Filling up the tank ain't what it used to be. Gone are the days when you were met with a smile and gasoline cost pennies. Times have certainly changed, and while we can't send you back in time, we can help you fill your tank for next to nothing. Just be one of the early bird winners of NHPR's Summer Car Raffle, and you could drive off with $2,000 in gas gift cards to any station of your choice. Tickets are just $50 or get 6 for $150 at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoi. Today, the science, history, and ethics of cat ownership and cat breeding. We're looking at the themes raised in a forthcoming episode of NHPR's Outside In. And let's hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Justine Paradise is with us in studio, producer for Outside In, our show about the natural world and how we use it. And her forthcoming story explores some of the issues that we're talking about, cat breeding and domestication, and the bigger scientific and societal issues around it. Joining us now by phone is David Grimm. He's a journalist who's written extensively about pets. His book is Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. And David, it's really nice to have you. Welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you guys so much.
I want to start off with how cats became domesticated, because a lot of people will say they're a lot more wild than dogs and you can't breed the wildness out of them. And if you let them out of your house for a month, they'd be fine because they just, you know, go out and hunt their food. What does it mean, first of all, David, for an animal in general and a cat in particular to be domesticated?
Yeah, you know, I think what kind of like Justine was alluding to, it's tricky, and I don't think anybody really agrees. I mean, we're just starting to discover some of the genes that might be responsible, but, you know, some people consider the rats in our cities domesticated because they've learned to live with us, you know, most people would not want to have a rat sleeping in their bed at night, you know. On the other hand, you know, there are animals like chickens that are domesticated and horses and things like that, but we have a very different relationship with the whole spectrum of domesticated animals. And so I don't think there's really consensus on what it means, but I think when most of us talk about domesticated, at least the way, you know, that I talk about domesticated, at least when it comes to cats and dogs particularly, it's the nature of the relationship. And is this an animal that, you know, you would, you know, consider part of your family, that you would let sleep in your bed, that you would let sleep in your children's bed? And I think when we apply those types of criteria, we're pretty much left with two animals, you know, and I don't want to be mean to the rabid people and the snake people and everything else, but, you know, certainly the numbers bear out that when we talk about the animals that we consider members of our family, members of our household, even animals that sometimes we would risk our lives for, it really comes down to two animals, and that's cats and dogs.
Well, so domestication, David, is a science, but also kind of a feeling. Is that what you're saying?
I think so. I mean, I feel terrible saying that as a former scientist, but I mean, you know, again, we don't really have the data yet to tell us, you know, this particular gene means that an animal is domesticated, this particular, you know, whatever, molecular pathway or whatever. We're just not there yet. And so some of it's science because we can say, well, clearly a dog is different from a gray wolf, which is its ancestor, and clearly a cat is different from the Near Eastern wildcat, which is a very wild, very feral animal that lives in the deserts of the Middle East, in Northern Africa. You know, though, if you put a Near Eastern wildcat next to a domestic tabby, they actually can look very similar, but behavior-wise, they're really miles apart. I mean, you can't get anywhere close to a Near Eastern wildcat. You know, the animal would try to tear your face off if you tried to hold it. I think one naturalist described the Near Eastern wildcat as one of the least amenable animals on the face of the earth. And, you know, and yet, you know, at least in my household, we have cats that, you know, we curl up with at night and, you know, sleep on our heads in the middle of the night, you know, and, you know, and again, you know, we certainly have no compunction about letting them hang out with our children. So from a look wise, they're similar, but personality wise, they're really, really miles apart.
Give us a little bit more too, Justine. You touched on this earlier, but, what scientists have been saying lately about domestication, and you mentioned that experiment, for example, about how dogs, when they get domesticated, they actually physically look different.
Sure. Well, one thing that Melinda Zeter said, who's a scientist with the Smithsonian, she's been studying domestication for years, she said domestication is a coevolutionary mutualistic relationship. And what she means by that is, I agree with you, David, it starts with a relationship, but then it becomes biological. And for instance, with herding animals like sheep and cows, Humans have actually changed with our tolerance for lactose. So we have also changed biologically with some of our relationship with domesticated animals. And I would say that some of our most intensive relationships with animals, like including dogs, when you look at people who are in working relationships with their dogs, I don't know, David, a lot of those people like would never sleep with their dogs, including sled dogs and
sure.
people who have hunting dogs. And so I think that it is a relationship, but that can vary quite a bit. But.
Well, it varies as much as people themselves vary
sure.
and as animals vary. You mentioned Melinda Zeder, senior scientist at the Natural History Museum at the Smithsonian Institution. She gave you a brief but very well done history of cat domestication. Let's hear a little bit from Melinda Zeder.
They were the ones who initiated the relationship. They were the ones who said, how do you do first?
This is what's called the commensal pathway to domestication. It's actually the same pathway that dogs took.
The less wary wolves, maybe the sort of beta wolves in the pack, you know, the loser ones, began to approach human settlements to feed off refuse.
This is just really funny to think of all dogs as kind of loser wolves.
Thank God my dog isn't in the room. He'd be very upset with me.
Again, that's Melinda Zeder talking with NHPR producer Justine Paradise about how cats and dogs became domesticated. And we're looking at the science, history, and ethics around this, especially given that some wild breeds are being talked about as, possibly difficult to manage in some situations. Join us with your comments and questions, 1-800-892-6477. Justine, I love the way she puts it. They were the ones who said, how do you do first?
Exactly. And David, you can jump in as you like. But I think that that's called the commensal pathway to domestication, which sort of means it happened gradually over time and almost naturally. And when we look at the Siberian fox fur farm experiment, scientists sort of it reinforced that theory, is my understanding, that people might have witnessed this happening rather quickly when it came to dogs. Cats were more, they saw it happening. They sort of tolerated each other. I think the Egyptians, and there were a couple different cultures that might have been exceptions where they valorized or worshipped cats. But largely, cats just sort of kicked around for a while.
Well, who were those early cats sort of hanging around the campfire, David? You know, you'd mentioned earlier some of the smaller wild cats are still pretty ferocious. So who were these early creatures?
Yeah, so the ancestor of the domestic cat is an animal called the Near Eastern wildcat. And like I said before, it looks very similar to kind of a mackerel tabby. It's kind of got the sandy patterned coat. And this is an animal that lived and still actually lives in the deserts of the Middle East, the Near East. And what's speculated to happen is maybe about 10,000 years ago. What's really significant is this is a time when humans are really starting to settle down, start villages and start farming. And what happened with the farming is they're growing grain, they're storing grain, and grain is drawing a lot of rodents into these villages. And who's following the rodents? It's these wild cats. These wild cats come into the villages to hunt and kill the rodents. They don't care about the cats, don't care about the people. They care about eating. But, once they get into these villages, it's a little easy to anthropomorphize, but if we can a little bit, the cats sort of, the way I sort of tell it, the cats sort of realized a good thing when they saw it. They said, hey, if I hang out in this village, if I don't give these people a really hard time, they're going to let me hang out here. Maybe they'll throw me some scraps. Let me keep on killing these mice. Obviously, it's great for the people because the cats are keeping down disease. They're protecting grain stores. So especially in places like ancient Egypt, which become very reliant on farming and also very plagued by things like snakes and scorpions, having cats around was actually like literally a lifesaver. Having a cat around would protect your family's food supply, would protect your children from being killed by a scorpion. And that's one of the speculations why cats became so venerated in Egypt, because without cats, you don't have ancient Egypt in some respects. It's true. I mean, I think with dogs, dogs, it became this commensal relationship that over time we molded into this much more, okay, now we've got these animals, let's mold them into hunters and guardians and companions and all this stuff. And with cats, it was like, hey, these guys are cool to have around, but we'll do our thing. Let's let them do their thing. And we can just sort of get along side by side without having to be sort of mold them as much as we have with dogs.
That's so interesting. Justine, it sounds like how people talk about cats today. They do their own thing. I do my thing. Once in a while, we get together.
Almost everyone said that to me. You know, my cat is, you know, doesn't need me. My cat, when he interacts with me, it's an honor.
And it's on his terms.
Yeah. And Abigail Tucker, you know, talked about, you know, we didn't get involved in cat breeding for a very long time, partly because it's difficult. Cat breeding is something like that. It's difficult when a cat, you have the cats sort of have to organically like each other.
And you can't do it by artificial insemination.
It's very difficult, and there's sort of reasons for that. That the cat breeding can be a little bit brutal to our eyes because of the way that the organs are. There's barbs on the male organ, so that stimulates ovulation. So it's hard to do that artificially, but you know, really, we didn't get involved in making specialized breeds in the same way that we did with dogs. You know, we have dogs that are good for mousing. We have dogs that are good, you know, as guard dogs. We have dogs that are good for herding. I went to Common Ground Fair a couple of years ago and watched dog herding sheep. And it was one of the most incredible things I've ever seen, the relationship between the herders and the sheepdogs. And to go back to our earlier point, the herders said, you know, if you have a sheepdog and it's not herding sheep, like that's what this dog needs to do. And just, I could see it in the dog's body. It was really one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. And I really think that dog breeding has reached this height that cats are not even close to.
Although, and what you said does raise, again, we keep coming back to that point. If you're going to get one of these dogs, mm-hmm. who is bred to, you know,
for
herd
this purpose,
sheep or whatever,
yeah.
You need to be prepared for that. And if you don't have sheep available, you need to make sure that the dog, you know, runs 10 miles a day or whatever. I remember after the movie 101 Dalmatians was re-released, Justine, I think, and a lot of people said, oh, let's get a Dalmatian.
Yes.
And I heard someone say, these are dogs that have been bred to run after fire engines and bite people. Maybe you shouldn't get one for your kid.
No, that there was a big spout of people getting dogs and then giving them up to the vet.
Wow.
That happened.
Because
and that, I mean,
of that.
That sort of speaks to pet ownership as being subject to the whims of fashion and trend just as much as any other type of consumption.
Again, our number for you to join us with your thoughts, questions, comments about the science, history, and ethics of cat ownership and some of the new cat breeding techniques that are going on that Justine is telling us about. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So getting back to our conversation about domestication and what that really means. And David, you said it's kind of genetic, but it's kind of also a feeling. People often say, David, that, you know, if domestication were a spectrum, cats would be near the bottom, dogs would be near the top, you know, scale of 1 to 10. What do you think about that, David?
Well, you know, I guess I first defer to the scientists, you know, and I've talked to scientists who feel both ways. There was a study that came out a couple of years ago trying to figure out, you know, how many, you know, genes for domestication cats have versus dogs. And they found that, you know, at least according to their study, cats had a lot fewer of these genetic markers for domestication. And the scientists I talked to said, you know, I basically consider cats a semi-domesticated animal. You know, they basically, they're just a subspecies of the wild cat.
Semi-domesticated.
Semi-domesticated. But I talked to another scientist who's, you know, a world expert on domestication, and he said that's baloney. You know, a cat is as domesticated as a dog. You know, it's not really a spectrum. It's more like an on and off switch. Either you're domesticated and you're not. And, you know, he gave me that sort of line about, you know, how many people have, you know, horses and chickens and pigs sleeping in their beds at night. You know, it's sort of like, there are the genetics, but then there is the nuts and bolts of the actual relationship, you know. And so, I certainly have my own feeling having two cats, so I feel, you know, certainly they have their wild side. But, for an animal that, you know, we have this type of relationship, this close relationship with, and, you know, it's probably beyond the scope of this program, but, you know, in the U.S., you know, we have all these laws that we pass specifically to protect cats and dogs, you know, compared to, you know, basically any other animal. And I think, you know, when you talk about the legal situation, the social situation, you know, Justine was talking about, you know, cats really sort of being in our households for the last few decades. I think that all should all factor into the domestication relationship as well. You know, what, as in terms of what do we consider a domesticated animal that we actually are able and willing to have this close relationship with.
That's interesting that one scientist told David, Justine, cats, they're semi domesticated.
Absolutely.
So, there's some debate in this.
Really, there is. And one thing that Abigail Tucker pointed out when I talked about the domestication syndrome earlier that Darwin observed and that people have subsequently observed is that cats do have the thing that is the one thing that all domesticated animals have, she said, which is the reduced brain size. It's about 30% smaller than the Near Eastern wildcat. And that basically just means that they don't have the flight, the fear responses, that which protects them with humans. You know, you don't want your cat running away from you, so you do have your cat sleeping in bed with you. But another reason that that people look at is the how quickly cats go feral. You know, within a lifetime, a cat can, if it escapes or is set free or is just born wild, can be quite skittish and, you know, live on the edges of our settlements. But one reason that people might say that it is domesticated is that feral cats are not found typically in true, quote, wild places. They're still in our cities and in our towns and close to human settlements because they are relying still on the rodents that are associated or the scraps that are associated with human settlements. You know, those feral cats is probably a whole program in itself because, you know, cats, there was a study a few years ago that said Scott R. Ross from the Smithsonian found that feral cats kill somewhere between 1.4 to 3.7 billion birds annually in the United States. And that was far greater numbers than we'd ever, you know, seen calculated before. And that article made a big splash. And that number is pretty wide because we don't even know how many feral cats there are out there in the world.
Right, because they're good at hiding and, you know, skulking around and so forth. You know, we've got an email from Christina about feral cats. She says, I found a kitten outside several years ago. It was alone and in distress. So I brought it to the vet and cleared the kitten. The kitten was cleared health-wise. He instructed us that the kitten was quite young, still required bottle feeding. We didn't have children at the time, Christina says, so we doted on him. The cat grew up to be extremely aggressive. It would allow us to pet him for 1 second, and then the next second he'd be wrapping his legs around our wrists and biting our hands. We joked that the cat was likely feral, but Christina says, I understood it as feral cats growing up in the wild versus cats raised by humans. So, Justine, do we know? Is there like a feral cat gene that can't be sort of petted out of you?
My understanding is that it's the sort of nature versus nurture. It's what environment
gotcha.
You grew up in. But I mean, I had a cat growing up that, you know, she grew up, she was never wild, she was never a feral cat, but she was afraid of us. And would, I mean, I think it depends on the individual. When I asked Leslie Lyons what the genes for tameness were, this geneticist, she basically said that we are still figuring it out. So I think it could vary individual to individual. I don't know if David might be able
yeah,
to speak
David,
to that
Yeah, David, go
more.
Ahead. Jump in. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I think what they say about cats is if they don't have any human interaction within the first, I can't remember how many weeks, but it's the first, if they don't have human interaction with the first several weeks of life, they basically become a wild animal. And I agree, that is a big difference between cats and dogs. And clearly there are feral dogs around the world, especially in places like China and India. And these feral dogs you also would not want to get close to. So it's not like only cats are able to revert to their wild state, but I think cats are more sensitive to that. So if cats don't have human interaction within their first few weeks of life, they're much more likely to be feral for life, and it's a very hard thing to boot first. And I don't think you see that as much in dogs. I think, to me, you know, as you know, sort of a cat person, I kind of view that more as kind of a cool thing than a detriment. You know, to me, it's sort of this toolbox they're able to access. And you know, even domestic cats, you know, I was outside with my 13-year-old cat, Jezebel, yesterday, and she's a very sweet cat, a little overweight, and she basically spends her time outside, you know, just kind of rolling around in the sun and kind of staring at birds. And, you know, she's very, you know, she's sort of about as far from
wild. David, I'm going to have to cut you off there for a second. We're going to a short break, but we'll pick it up after that. And, you know, your comments fit in perfectly with what Christina said, that even though she got this cat very young, it seemed rather feral for most of its life. Christina, thanks for the email, and we'll be back after a short break. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, we're looking at the history, science, and ethics of cat domestication and cat ownership, picking up on some of the themes that will be raised in a forthcoming episode of NHPR's Outside In. The producer of that episode, Justine Paradise, is with us. Also joining us by phone, David Grimm, journalist who's written extensively about societal views, science, and knowledge of pets. He's author of the book Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. We'd love to hear from you, too. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So, David, just before the break, we were responding to Christina's email, just basically wondering about, you know, can a cat be inherently feral, or can the feralness, if I could put it that way, be petted out of him or her? And you were finishing up a story there, so go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, so basically, I have this 13-year-old cat, Jezebel. She's very, as far as you can get from a wild animal. I was just hanging outside with her, and all of a sudden there was this kind of rustling in the bushes, barely perceptible to me, but all of a sudden her eyes dilate, her ears perk up, and she is just, and she just laser focused on what's happening in those bushes, and jumps in there. She didn't get anything, but it's like, she went from basically domestic to wild in about 2 seconds flat, and and then she comes back and she wants to be petted and she's rolling over and whatever. But I think I sort of view that as, some people view that as a detriment. I kind of view that as an asset. The cats have this, they still have this kind of wild part of their brain that they're able to access when they need to, and sometimes it turns on. Maybe not the right time, but it's this toolkit that they haven't completely lost over the course of about 10,000 years.
I want to ask both of you about a subject that's a little bit touchy, but it does come up in your episode, Justine. What does it mean to be a good "quote unquote" cat owner? What is ethical cat ownership? And Justine, I won't ask you to say what you think, weigh in on this, but what are some of the questions that come up when you talk about the ethics of owning a cat, an animal that some people, as David said, believe is just semi-domesticated?
Right. Well, this is the basic question that a lot of people touch on is indoor or outdoor, right? So if you're an outdoor cat, the thing that I mentioned earlier about feral cats, they're great at hunting. That's what they're built to do. So catching mice, catching birds can be really detrimental to the environment around you. So do you have outdoor cats? You could build a structure. You could have a bell on the cat's collar. That doesn't always work. Cats are pretty smart in a lot of ways. So the other option is indoor cats. But that leads to a lot of similar conditions that humans sometimes see, being overweight or having certain like liver and kidney diseases. We actually share some of the same health problems with cats and dogs. And that can also make them, they can go a little nuts sometimes being in the apartment. They can want to be outside and want more stimulation, tear up your house. I mean, but that some of that's instinctual behavior, like scratching on the couch. That's just something that they're wired to do and climb. They're wired. If you're expecting a cat not to climb, it's in my mind, it will be a bit of a losing battle.
Yeah. You've written about this. Sorry to interrupt, Justine, but David, you've written strongly about this, inside or outside. Some people say one is unethical and some people say the other is unethical.
Yeah, it certainly is. It's a very hot button issue. I mean, I think we need to start from the point about, cats are, by some estimations, the world's most popular pet. And I think part of that is because they're fairly easy, or people view them as fairly easy. Oh, I can leave my cat alone all day, or I can let my cat out for a few days, and, he'll go hunt his own food and poop outside. I don't want to deal with it. But also from the inside, I can just keep my cat indoors for a week, a week while I go away from vacation, my cat doesn't really care about me, so, he doesn't mind that I'm away all day. But, I think we need to start from, and this is obviously my opinion, but I think we need to start from what is best for the animal. What was this animal what did this animal evolve to do? And, for better and for worse, even though cats, are domesticated, they've evolved to be hunters and climbers and predators. And I feel like they don't get that much in the house, unless you've got a house full of insects or rodents. They're not getting that stimulation. And we certainly see that with our male cat, Jasper, that, we let him out for about an hour a day and I supervise him. One of the reasons people say don't let your cats out is because, they get hit by cars, and we live in the city in Baltimore, and that's really a concern. So the way I try to balance things is I let him out for about an hour, but I try to keep an eye on him so he's not. I try to keep him from killing things, but also from being killed. But what I find is that when he comes back in after that hour, he's a much more relaxed cat. He's calm. He's almost like, thank you for letting me like express myself and be a cat for a little bit. And now I'm going to come in and I'm going to curl up in the sun and I'll sit in your lap. Whereas we found he's gone a few days without being able to go outside, he gets cranky, you know, and we call it depressed, but we don't, you know, again, we're anthropomorphizing a little bit, you know, he seems to be in a funk. And I sort of feel like it's just something he needs, you know.
So, and, David, let me jump in and ask you a quick question, please. So you say you live in Baltimore, so that's a pretty dangerous place for a cat to be, I would imagine. So how do you, quote unquote, supervise him?
Well, this is the part where you probably hang up on me, but we used to walk our cats on leashes. We were crazy cat people, you know, and we got little dog harnesses for them and walked them on leashes. And walking cats on leashes isn't very easy, and you get a lot of looks from people, but it's also a great way to meet your neighbors.
Yeah, they say, wow, you're walking a cat.
Yeah, exactly. But now we sort of live in a place, we're still in the city, but we have a bit of a courtyard. And so we let the cats, and I basically, you know, I keep an eye on them, you know, and I try to keep them out of the street. It's not easy and it's more work, but I think, you know, to honor that relationship and say, I could on one hand keep a cat inside all day and not, you know, and sort of not let them do what they were sort of kind of born to do, or I can make my life a little bit harder where I spend a half an hour outside, outside every day with them, but they're getting something out of it, you know, and maybe it's not the most thrilling half hour of my life. But, you know, I'm sort of trying to honor that relationship that, like, this is something that's very stimulating, that's very good for them. And as long as they're not getting hurt, you know, it's building my relationship with them, but it's also letting them sort of be the animal that they were sort of born to be.
So that's your sort of compromise, David, with the people
who
worry about, you know, especially for birds. Eric in Manchester says cats are bird assassins. I've heard globally that cats kill 1 trillion birds every year, Eric says. Do domestic cats kill birds as much as feral cats? I think, Justine, you said earlier, we don't know. Eric says, should we ban people from allowing their cats outdoors without a leash? So it sounds like you've sort of tried to find a middle ground there.
I think there is a middle ground there. I mean, I think that if you go outside, I mean, we take our dogs outside. We don't just let our dogs out and let them roam the neighborhood and mate with whoever they want and poop on whoever's, you know, lawn that we want. We take that responsibility. Like, we say, I'm going to take my dog out, but I'm going to be a responsible owner. I think we do the same thing with the cats. I'm not going to let my cat out for a little bit, but I'm going to be a responsible owner. I'm going to try to keep that cat from killing birds, which is what I do with my cats. I'm also going to try to prevent my cat from being killed by a car or a coyote or whatever. And I think we should take the same responsibility with our cats that we do with our dogs. And that would allow the cats to be outside, but allow them to be safe and maybe less destructive than they would be otherwise.
Well, we know a lot now about ticks being carried by white-footed mice and other rodents. So, not necessarily birds, but there is some interest in the cat's ability to kill these white-footed mice that carry ticks, which carry disease. Let's go to Manchester, and Ed's calling from Manchester. Hi, Ed. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you this morning?
Fine. Thanks for calling, Ed.
Well, I've been working with feral cats since 1999.
Oh, wow.
I trap and tame them and find homes for them, working with feline rescue groups in the area. I'm also an animal behaviorist. So a few things I'd like to kind of clear up here. Cats that are trapped, feral cats, there's a scale that I made up from 0 to 10, 0 being it's a kitten born from a feral mom, all the way up to a cat that has never had human contact, and it might be several generations that have not had human contact. So my scale goes from, like I said, 0 to 10. If you have a kitten that's 3 weeks or less, it takes me about a week or two to totally tame them.
Just a week or two? That's not very long, Ed.
No, it's not. It's a matter of handling them. And as far as, further down the scale, an 8-week-old kitten takes about 1 to 3 weeks to totally tame. And then anything 12 weeks and older can take 3 to 6 months. And then it kind of goes up from there. And cats that have been left, people who leave their cats, they move and they're just very irresponsible.
Right.
I've trapped and actually gotten the history of some of these cats from local neighbors saying, you know, this family moved. It's been out here for 5 years. And one of those, it broke a canine tooth off in the trap. It ripped the claw out of its paw completely. That's how wild it was.
Wow. So, okay, so trap and tame, that's what you do, Ed. How right. hard is it?
Well, this particular cat I started to talk about, that cat was domesticated, and it was only took 3 weeks to bring it completely around to being completely tame. So if a cat has been a pet for a while and is let out to fend for itself, it reverts to being
revert to that behavior. Ed, super interesting. David, what do you think? What a interesting line of work, trapping and taming feral cats. Thanks for the call, Ed.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's people out there that really, you know, it's funny, you know, we have cats, but we have feral cats, and sometimes people sort of consider them two different animals, you know, but they are, you know, biologically, genetically the same animal, and, you know, and I love it that people are out there. We don't talk about, we're not out there sort of trapping and helping feral squirrels for the most part, or raccoons or anything. I mean, we're certainly helping wildlife, but I mean, the level that people will go to sort of say, this is an animal that we have some responsibility for, you know, the cat, you know, this is an animal that's been part of our society for 10,000 years. That's been very important to our society at various points. You know, this is an animal that, you know, we feel a kinship with, that we have responsibility. I just love these stories of people going out there and trying to save these animals, whether or not that they become domestic in the process, or whether they're just doing things like trap, neuter, and release, or having cat colonies that are, you know, trying to take care of these animals in the wild. I think it gets back to this idea of what is our relationship with this animal. And I think that speaks to us having a very different relationship with the cat than we have with a lot of other animals on
right.
the planet.
That's what makes it interesting. Justine, go ahead.
Sure. I mean, I think that this also speaks to cats are, in my mind, pretty unlikely candidates for domestication. They're solitary. Dogs are pack animals. A lot of the animals that we domesticated are pack animals. They need high protein diets, which means that they're competing for the same resources that humans are, you know, meat. You know, the pet industry is an estimated $72 billion in the U.S. in 2018, and that's a lot of money that we're putting. Cats are 94.2 million pet cats in the United States, which is almost as many house cats as people with college diplomas, as a colleague pointed out to me the other day. Just the amount of resources, both money and protein and space that we give to cats, to an animal that is really a solitary apex predator, it's not, if you were a betting person in the Neolithic times, you wouldn't bet on the Near Eastern wildcat to have reached this unprecedented level beyond any other feline's wildest dreams.
Well, the money and the competition for resources, and also the time people spend just looking at cat videos, my goodness,
yeah.
on the internet. So,
And to me, it's interesting because, you know, the forage fish, the small fish, is not something that we have a lot of empathy for, it's not something that we are interested in conserving. And cats, in their pet food, consume about 10% of the global forage fish industry, or the Chilean forage fish industry. And it's interesting to me when we're thinking about wild and what kind of animals we love, when by loving certain animals, you're sort of also saying, I will give you these resources, and it is they're carnivorous, you know. It's a fascinating dynamic that we have with the rest of the natural
and
world.
If you're a vegetarian, you know, for ethical reasons, but you have a cat, you're basically somewhat involved, Justine, in that food chain of meat production,
right? And it's not just fish. The industrial meat industry complex is a different episode altogether, but I mean, cat food would be with part of that.
All right. Well, Paula on Facebook says, what do your panelists think about the new trend in cat cafes? These are coffee shops where you can go in and grab a cup of coffee and pet a cat. These cats are wandering freely everywhere. My son and future daughter-in-law told me about one they visited in Paris last week, but I understand there are also several popping up in the United States. Thank you, Paula, for the Facebook comment. I remember the first time I went to France and I saw people bringing their dogs in, and I thought that was weird. But I had not heard, David, about cat cafes.
Yeah, you know, one of my favorite things that I heard when I was researching my book was this idea of, you know, why are cats so popular on the internet? And this person who I was talking to, his sort of theory was, because we see dogs all the time. You know, even if you're not a dog person and you don't own a dog, you can't walk down the street of any big city or almost anywhere without seeing people walking dogs. You know, dogs are all on television. They're just everywhere. Whereas, you know, to sort of see a cat, you've got to own a cat almost. And you know, they were saying, well, that's why cat videos have become so popular, is because it's sort of the cat equivalent of dog walking. It's a way to sort of get cats out there into the public consciousness that they wouldn't always already be there. And I sort of feel like that's similar with cat cafes. That, you know, now we're developing these spaces where even if you're not a cat person and you don't own a cat, now we've got these spaces where you can actually interact with cats in a much more sort of intimate way that we only used to be able to interact with dogs. So, and we just had one open up in Baltimore. I haven't been to it yet. But yeah, I just love that they're springing up all over the place, because I think it's going to bring, you know, I think a lot of people don't like cats because they don't know cats. And I really hope that with cat cafes, you know, people will actually be able to sort of interact with these animals and maybe in a way that they haven't before.
Well, of course, people who are allergic should know to avoid them. Justine, last question for you. What was the most surprising thing that you learned working on this episode? And it'll be forthcoming soon, so folks can keep an ear out for it. But boy, there's a lot in here. There's science, there's history, there's societal feelings and expectations and so on and so forth.
Absolutely. I mean, I think part of what was surprising was how the thing that I was so most interested in was this conflict between wildness and tameness and trying to get both in the same package, and just how aware and explicit that was in the language around the Bengal cat breed. And breeders would explicitly say it right out. They knew what they were doing. And, you know, I get it. You know, I want to relate to wildness and see wildness in my daily life as well. So it's an understandable impulse.
The Lion in the Living Room, as the title of that book puts it. Justine, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
That's Justine Paradise, producer for NHPR's Outside In, our show about the natural world and how we use it. And David Grimm, it was also good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you guys so much.
David Grimm, journalist. His book about our relationship with cats and dogs is called Citizen Canine. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.